on FM, online, and on TuneIn 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
Here on the Space Show, we delight in bringing news of the current space missions. The Mars 2020 rover Perseverance and helicopter Ingenuity are examples of this in this evening's program. Space missions don't just happen. In the United States, NASA periodically sends out requests for ideas for new space missions. After considering these ideas, the people at NASA headquarters post requests for specific mission types. Teams of investigators, engineers and scientists are formed. They spend months, sometimes years, developing their proposals. By a due date, they then submit their costed and detailed plan to headquarters. The competing proposals are evaluated by an independent group of experts who eventually make a recommendation to headquarters. If the relevant NASA administrator accepts the recommendation, the winning team is advised. Now, they can set to work making the necessary instruments and building the spacecraft. NASA goes ahead and orders the necessary rocket to propel the craft into space. Now, what of the losing bidders, you may ask? Well, like losing bidders at a property or art auction, they have to swallow their disappointment and move on with their life. Sometimes the bidders get another chance to submit the same, or more usually, a modified proposal several years later in another round. For example, those preparing a mission to explore Pluto lost out many times before getting lucky with their modified plan called New Horizons. On this evening's The Space Show, we hear from one of the losing bidders for a mission to Mars. The Ames Research Center at Mountain View at the southern end of San Francisco Bay is a NASA center. They answered a call from NASA headquarters with a plan to send a spacecraft to the polar region of Mars to investigate the ice beneath the surface. Australian David Wilson worked at Ames and was on the icebreaker team. The search for evidence of life on Mars is the ultimate motivation for the scientific exploration of that planet. The results from previous missions, and the Phoenix mission in particular, indicate that the Martian soil is ice-rich and is likely to be the most recently habitable place on Mars. The late David Wilson was involved in a proposal to send a life-detecting mission called Icebreaker to a high-latitude region of Mars. Now, David was also the Vice President of Mars Society Australia, as well as being the Research and Development Engineer in the Space Science and Astrobiology Division of the Ames Research Centre. He spoke in 2016 at a joint Mars Society Australia and Space Association event here in Melbourne.
Carl, we have been developing Icebreaker Search for Life, and this is using the Phoenix lander, which is also the lander that is going to be launched next year. And our plan was to drill 1 meter down into ice-cemented soils to land high in the northern hemisphere, 70 degrees north, in the same region as Phoenix landed, and drill down 1 meter, into the soil, bring up the cuttings and provide them to three instruments, the Wickel, an instrument called SOLID, and the Laser Desorption Mass Spectrometer, LDMS. And basically the aim was to look for life that might be frozen in the top surface soil. So I think I was on this for a year and a half. It was quite an experience. So drilling, I guess Honeybee Robotics, it was their drill that we've got planned for, and they've developed a technique where you drill down 10 centimetres, bring the cuttings up, catch them, drill down another 10 centimetres, bring the cuttings up. And the reason why is there's a great possibility of the drill stings getting frozen into the ground. And they've had, through their own experience, the Arctic For example, there are regions there where there are honeybee drill strings still in the ground after them going there and drilling into the ground, and they were frozen in the ground. The drill string needs a thermometer or a thermocouple to make sure the ice isn't melted. When it's melted and then refreezes, the drill's frozen. So there's quite a technology behind drilling into the ice-cemented soil, and this is the kind of regions. It's a flat plain, and we know that there's ice or ice-cemented soil within a few inches from the surface. So we hopefully expect there'll be lots of organics in the ice, frozen in the ice. These are studies that actually I did to show how we can get the stuff or the cuttings from the drill into the various instruments, which I'll cover in just a minute. And I've been working on a scoop, which can, in this case, the scoop that I've done is, it can excavate, filter and dispense everything in the one go, as well as capture cuttings from the drill as it comes. Hopefully that can come around. So this mission had three instruments. One was SOLID, which was an instrument developed in Spain, which uses antibodies. And antibodies have been bred in rabbits. Lots of rabbits have been breeding antibodies, which were destined to capture particular organic molecules. So that molecules like ATP and DNA molecules and lipids, for example. And this would be a sure sign of life, obviously. And the antibodies are fixed to a plate. They have free-floating ones with markers. They grab and the floating sample, if there's any molecules in the sample that fit the keys, then it can capture it and the laser can see it. The sample has to be sonicated and pulverized or with sonic sound before it can be fed through. And the next one was the laser desorption mass spectrometer, where we fire a laser at the sample, it turns into a plasma, and then we read the spectrum, and from that we can decide on what the consistency of the sample is. And finally, we looked at habitability, which is the Wickel instrument, which was on the Phoenix. And that's basically a container where you put the sample in the container, add water, and then you measure the electric current and the voltage between electrodes inside, and you're looking for salts and salt concentrations. And this instrument was the one that discovered perchlorates, which is quite an important material in the surface. So when we land, we invite our Martian guests, if there are any, to come on board. And first of all, we sonicate them. We vaporize them with a laser. And then we electrocute them. And then we say, we come in peace, guys. Thank you. And there we are. So this is dirt de data. I'm not sure how the Martians would appreciate all that, but one of the big issues in looking for life is, how do you know if you've found life or have you found what you might have brought in with you from Earth? And actually that is a killer for many biologists, biology reviewers or science guides. How do you know this is not Earth life? If the life on Mars or elsewhere is similar to Earth, how do you know it's not Earth life? And so we have to put everything in biobarriers that will be handling the sample and demonstrate that those biobarriers will be successful. And that's actually what I'm doing that with students very soon at NASA Ames. And by the way, we've had Australian students at NASA Ames. At the moment, we've got a New Zealander there, and he's going to help out with this biobarrier project. And they all scrub up very well, by the way. So this is the deck. It's very tight. We had a lot of problems fitting. There's a drill inside its biobarrier. There's a biobarrier for the scoop. We had a lot of trouble fitting it on. It took a long time to figure that one out. So one thing that I did was built a full-size mock-up, and this is what we'll use to test biobarriers with the students.
This evening on The Space Show, our guest is David Wilson, who at the time he was speaking in 2016 was the Vice President of Mars Society Australia and a Research and Development Engineer at the Space Science and Astrobiology Division of the Ames Research Centre, which is in California. Well, After that talk, he offered to answer questions, and of course, there were plenty of them.
With the drilling activity, obviously when the spacecraft lands, you can have lots of contamination from the rocket engine, things like that. How are you guys thinking about managing that?
We did talk a lot about, let's go to the icebreaker, we did talk a lot about there may well be organics inside the rocket engine propellant. There's certainly organic compounds in the propellant. That's Lockheed made that clear. Of course, when they burn it, it's burnt at 1,000 plus degrees. It burned at a very high temperature. And these are the little engines, by the way, down here. They're little guys down here. They're actually pulse engines, and they control them by switching them on and off. This is a very neat and simple way of doing it. I've diverted slightly from your question, probably deliberately. So the problem may be was when they vent the propellant out. And that's one reason why we need to drill down under the top soil. Yes, it's clear that once you punch through the top soil or engage the top soil, you may in fact be engaging microbes that are in the propellant. And that's an aspect we never really got into properly. We did, I believe, so I have to be going back several years. I think what we did look at or talk about that the propellant would be filtered with very fine filters that could filter out microbes. But it doesn't mean bits of organics don't go in. So certainly any discovery of life on the very surface might be deemed as a bit dubious. But once we get down deeper, then the arguments will come stronger.
Or yeah. You burn them up and vaporize
them. Yes, yeah. Spray hydrogen all over. Yeah, not only that, but we burn them first with big rocket engines and then spray them with the hydrazine and then sonicate, then fire a laser, then electrocute and say, thanks, guys, we come in peace. Yeah. This is what you do, you know.
It's
well, I don't want to say that.
At this joint Mars Society Australia and Space Association event, Space Association of Australia President Peter Arwood had this question.
Oh, hi, David. I'd like to sort of understand your story a little bit about how you got to where you are now, and also how NASA works in the sense of the project you personally are working on, your department, how that fits in with the budget and the longer term sort of plan of NASA. Is it sort of, you know, the way it is now till the next administration, or is it sort of a longer term process, or do you just sort of make up your own date?
I guess I'm only giving it from my perspective. So the NASA institution that I'm in is very like a university, and lots of people have grants to do things. But most of my funding has come from working on these sort of projects like the Icebreaker and Enceladus. And the Red Dragon, there was the NASA Ames was very keen to promote that. At the time, the director was very keen to embrace the private industry and encourage that aspect. So he quite a large team was assembled. I guess 12, a dozen guys and women were assembled to look at the Red Dragon on Mars. And most of the funding that I've been involved in is from that. And also I've had grants to, like, develop the scoop at the bottom and instrument prototypes, I think. A subcritical water extractor was one thing I worked on for a while. The institutions, there's, I think, 10 NASA institutions, plus ones like JPL, which are not really NASA institutions, and also APL, they're private institutions that work for NASA. Generally, most people get on very well, but the institutions themselves, there's always a fight for funding and so on. But hopefully that doesn't get in the way with science. And then, of course, so there's the Science Mission Directorate, and then there's the Human Exploration Mission Directorate. And those guys are for going back to Mars, or they're for people in space, human exploration. And I've had some dealings with those people through the spacesuit work, which I showed, and also John and I have been involved in the first landing selection of landing sites for the first Mars mission. Generally, people are working on their own thing. At the moment, IceBrag was part of a Discovery mission, the Discovery program, which was a $500 million funded PI-led mission. And that's where a PI or a guy stands up and says, well, I'm planning a mission to Mars to look for life, and here it is, and here's my team. And then there's a lot of reviewers that go through it all and see whether you can do it and whether they want it or not and whether the science is strong and whether the mission has any weaknesses in it. Generally, they're horribly conservative. So, and then there's flagship missions where basically NASA just says to someone, go forth and build Skycrane and land a very large rover on Mars, and that's a flagship mission. And the budgets, it's much easier to work in those missions, even though technically the Skycrane and Curiosity is a big achievement. So those things were very difficult to get together. And then the Enceladus mission is part of the New Frontiers program, where that's generally for the outer planets. And they're larger budgets too, by the way. They're like twice the budget of a Discovery program. So they have programs to go and explore, which are sized, have various sizes. And then there's grants and funding for various types of technology. So it's not a cohesive organization in the sense like SpaceX or a company. It's think of more like NASA as a research institution. I think that's the best way to describe it.
Unfortunately, Icebreaker was proposed for the NASA Discovery Program in the 2015 round of applications for funding. In the final analysis, it lost out to the Psyche and Lucy missions to the asteroid belt. Now, Psyche is due to be launched later this year and Lucy next year. It has been proposed again. Last year, the proposal was put in again for a 2026 launch. Well, we've just got time, I think, for a final question from David Aylward.
I'm just curious, with NASA and SpaceX, they've got the contract for the commercial cargo and...
And, of course, I'm a bit confused. It's David Wilson who's talking, and the question is from Peter Aylward.
And a crew vehicle. Does NASA own any IP over the Dragon or the Red Dragon vehicle for them to go off and use on their own mission?
Yeah, I can't really answer that question. I suspect not, except the bits that they provide or SpaceX have adopted from, like, the Orion program. The COTS mission program I suppose the equivalent is a fixed-price contract, and the companies, you agree that whatever the company is providing is what you want. You don't necessarily know the details of it, but you're giving them a lump of money and they're doing a job, and that's... more or less, they're doing it for a fixed price. And whereas companies like Lockheed and Boeing that work for NASA are more or less like consultants. They're working on an hourly rate. And, well, I argue that the fixed price contract approach works where the risks are manageable, where you know what the risks are and you can define them. Whereas if you don't know what the risks are, and there are too many unknowns, you might be better off with a consultancy sort of approach. That's just my opinion. But because some of these things can... I guess the James Webb Telescope is a good example. That's blown its budget hugely. And hopefully when it flies, it'll be a magnificent instrument. But it's certainly a lot more expensive than what people expected. But if somebody asked them to build it on a fixed-price contract... they may charge double what's been spent on it already, so because there's so many unknowns to it. I worked in fixed price contracts for the mining and also cost plus, and this is in Australia, and I know if you know what needs to be provided, you know it's very clear and obvious, you can do it quite nicely on a fixed price with a low margin. If you don't know, you start bumping your margins up and putting in money. One advantage of a cost plus is that you can pull the plug if you think it can't be done, if you get to a point, but generally that's not the case. Yeah, I think if somebody came to you and said, go and build a space rocket to fly to the moon, what would you say at the top of your head? Well, it probably costs several billion dollars, but that's multiplied by 20 just to make sure, and that's the fixed price, because you don't know, there's too many unknowns. That's why the COTS program came in, to try and nail down, like the flights to the space station, was to try and cap those and make them, contain them, and get it into get this part of the work handed over to the commercial world, because they can do that. When the risks are manageable and they can repeat it over and over again, that's where you get the savings.
The thoughts of David Wilson, Vice President at the time of Mars Society Australia, also Research and Development Engineer of Space Science and Astrobiology at the Ames Research Centre in California. And sadly, David died in 2018. He was speaking here in Melbourne 2 years before that. Well, you may say, why all this thing about Mars? Why go to Mars? Well, Sharav Jain comes from India and last year put down these thoughts.
Why go to Mars when our Earth is vast? Stop destroying Earth for greed of Mars. If you discover Earth's beautiful parts, you will never think about Mars. Why go to Mars when our Earth is vast? If Earth is onerous, Mars is even hard. If Earth is beautiful, Mars is dark. Earth is a heaven in front of Mars. Why go to Mars when our Earth is vast? Mars is a planet without any parks, no beautiful flowers but only dark. Still the world plans to go on Mars. Why go to Mars when our Earth is vast? Our Mother Earth is bleeding all its parts. Let's help our Mother Earth in healing its parts. So let's bring a change, forgetting about our past.
That was the thoughts of Sharav Jain. She comes from India and recorded that last year.